This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Me and the Latvian Eagle here did a little duck hunting this morning. Does that make you jealous, Chris Dombrowski?
It does. It does. I did a little driving this morning.
Did you? Well, we're out enjoying the wilds. Chris, do you mind if we run through a couple news points?
I'd love that.
Let's do introductions.
All right.
I'll introduce you.
Okay, sounds good.
Author. I don't get to say this very often. Author and poet. Do you know Saddam Hussein had books of poetry?
Come on. Don't start with that.
You don't believe me?
No, I'm kidding.
He had multiple works of poetry. Wow. And when the Iraq War was going on, I would often catch myself saying the novelist and poet Saddam Hussein. Because he had published novels and published books of poetry.
Wow.
Yeah. So similar to Saddam, Chris Dombrowski has... No, you don't have any novels.
No novels. Not yet.
Books of poetry. I think that you're probably the first poet. The first actual real live publishing poet that we've had on the show.
That's fantastic.
Well, I mean, there's only three of you.
Yeah.
Harrison's dead.
Right. That's true. That's true. It was his birthday yesterday, by the way.
Oh, it was?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chris used to guide. You were like a guide for Jim Harrison.
Yeah, I rode Jim.
You rode
down
him?
The river. Guiding is probably a... You know, not quite an accurate
word. Was there
an
exchange of money?
No.
So you guys were just hanging out.
Yeah. And every time I would, you know, have an idea, he would say, go to the other bank, you know. So if anything, he was guiding, but not rowing.
I got you. So you were just like a facilitator.
Facilitator, a wine opener, dispenser of chicken thighs.
Well, you got a lot of, you know, as a guide, right? You've seen 1,000 people cast, right?
Ooh, yeah.
Is he a good fisherman?
He was an exceptionally good caster.
Absolutely.
Really? I remember being so thrilled when the first time I saw him cast and I realized that he could actually cast, you know, because I grew up in Michigan. I worked for this.
As did he.
As did you. As did so many Michitanans. But, you know, I can remember I worked at this lodge up in Grayling as a kid and the experts, the so-called experts would come through. And you'd always be so disappointed when you actually saw them cast. You know, they were so bad compared to, you know, your buddies and whatnot. So the first time I saw Jim cast, I thought, all is well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is a relief.
I know.
As a guide, when you see a client cast and they're good and you've never seen it before, it's definitely just like,
Yeah.
But then you hope that doesn't come with some real shitty expectations.
Yeah,
right?
It usually reverses the karma, right? You know?
Yanni, if you're telling me that your mic is 2 fingers off your lip, yeah,
he's got really big hands.
April Volkey, are you familiar with? Have you ever met Chris before?
No, we haven't met. We met about 5 minutes ago.
Oh, okay, had you seen his book around?
I saw it this afternoon. Sorry, Chris, but I'm excited to learn more about it.
We sprang this on April. We didn't give April the long lead time.
Well, I'm glad you did.
In order to go read up on Body of Water.
Ryan actually sprung it on me last night because I was podcasting Ryan this morning or this afternoon. And I said, I'll see you tomorrow. He goes, oh, yeah, for the Chris podcast. And I went, who? What? So, but what a pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm glad I didn't know.
You guys share professional connections, though, because of the whole, you know, fishing world. But are you a guide still?
I still guide about 80 days a year. Yep.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
I'd count that as still being a guide.
Yeah. Dude, we have at this table right now are 4 people who have at some point in their life been professional fly fishing guides.
Are you the only one who hasn't?
I'm the one that hasn't.
The smart one with the thriving business.
Man, I don't, dude, you know, so that meaning there's 4 people at this table who whore themselves out.
Oh,
and one who's
just stop. Don't open that can.
One who's pure as the driven snow.
I think it's real good for recruitment purposes that you never guided anybody.
that's the voice of Ryan Callahan, who's also here, and then Yanni Chimani.
Hello.
So we talked about that. Oh, I was asking you a couple news items.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A dude, okay, a guy in Alaska, check this out. A guy in Alaska just got jail time and a $100,000 fine for poaching some moose. Man, those guys do not mess around in Alaska.
What do you mean some moose?
Because he killed three, he killed and ditched three moose.
Why?
Here's what they think. You know, okay, we talked about this before. Like in Alaska, depending on where you are, there's always exceptions, but generally, like generally, for a bull moose to be legal in Alaska, it has to be either, depending on where you are, has to be either a three, have three brow tines on one side, or be 50 inches tip to tip antler spread. Or you might be in a unit that's a, what you'd call a four brow tine unit, where it has to have four brow tines on one side, or and or be 50 inch tip to tip. And then there's other units that are like any bull, whatever. But typically you're either, it's either a three brow tine or four brow tine area. And it's, when we're hunting moose, like it's real nice to see the brow tines, because gauging 50 inch tip to tip is some tricky shit. Real trick. It's nerve wracking. Like to shoot, there's a lot of guys, like my brother Danny's a very experienced moose hunter. He is not, it makes him very uncomfortable to shoot a bull on spread and to not shoot a bull on brow tine count. But it seems like this feller was just real bad at, seems like real bad at judging. And he'd kind of check them once they were down to see if they're legal. Three of them, $100,000 fine. I like that, man.
I was going to say, so be it. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty ignorant.
Because now and then you hear some dude doing some like egregious stuff and he winds up with a misdemeanor and has to do like a day of community service. They don't mess around, man. Like no. Alaska does not mess around on game and fish violations. They treat it like business.
Is there not some sort of calculation that you can make from afar?
Yeah. So that's where the stuff gets tricky. If he, like, let's say he's broadside and turns his head to look at you, there's all these little tricks. Like if that outside swoop hits the midpoint on his hump, or you know that a standard run-of-the-mill bull is 20 ear to ear. I can't remember.
I can't either, but it's out there.
There's a measurement of like, hey, like your typical mature bull is X inches ear to ear.
Might be so, 30, 10 per ear and plus 10 in between.
Yeah, so you got like that, and then you imagine, does it go, you know, a percentage of that, what, all this stuff. But what you arrive at is, unless, like a friend of mine who's a guide, is like, unless you look at it and you're like, you know, it blow, like you feel that your heart's going to stop because it's obviously 80 inches.
Don't shoot.
Don't mess around.
So wait, did they count? Did they measure then? Did it come in at like 49?
One was, I read the article. I can't remember the other ones, but one, the biggest one was around 45.
Okay. Did he take any part of the animal?
It says most of all three went to waste.
Ooh. Most? So was he stripping backstraps and stuff?
You know, you're asking a lot of great questions.
I'm curious about this.
I think that we'd have to do a little more reading.
Hmm.
A buddy of mine just sent me the article, so I'm a little bit guilty of having not done a ton of research, but the outline of it, I have a sense of the outline, but that, it said like left most to rot.
Sounds like 100,000's fair.
That's big.
Yeah. And I do, I was wondering if there's a little more to the story, because I can see that price tag climbing. If I can see that fine being less, if it was like, guy was caught with three moose that were fully processed going to feed his family versus...
Oh, the ditching? The ditching of? Yeah. Definitely probably colors it, man.
Didn't do him any favors.
Past violations probably cover it.
Yeah.
Some states have a thing where if it's a trophy animal, then your fines go through the roof.
Yeah.
Poaching a trophy class animal costs you a lot more money than if you're like a pot hunter, then they slap you down harder. What a couple other things I want to talk about. Oh, guy had some feedback on something. Cal, you were here for this conversation where our buddy Steve Kendrot, this is tricky. Check this out, Chris. Our buddy Steve Kendrot shoots a sika deer down in Maryland, and it's missing a tine, an antler tine. His buddy shoots a sika deer, and he's skinning it, and there, lo and behold, is Steve Kendrot's antler tine embedded in the buck. So these are pugnacious little fighters, you know. And he snaps his antler tine off in the buck. And so the guy kept the antler tine. Steve was able to take the antler tine and match it up. And I was saying how I felt that if that friend of his was an honorable friend, he'd have given Steve Kendrot the antler tine. Steve Kendrot. Oh, see, I'm glad you said that. Because everybody that wrote in was
we took a vote at that day at the table. And I think, Cal, you said you made a good point that, well, maybe the story, because I agreed with you, like he should have just given it to him. But Cal said, well, the story's just as good if the antler tine's hanging like near that trophy, that head, because he's like, this is what I had in my neck and I was still alive, right? But go ahead.
Well, one of the many guys that wrote in about it was looking at it like this. He says, contrary to my personal opinion, Steve's opinion, he's like, the fight between these two things happened outside the realm of man. The fight was the fight, and it didn't involve people, and there's no room to weigh in on the people perspective. They had a fight, and he likens it to this. Let's say you got in a knife fight, or let's say someone came up and stabs you in the leg, and in the scuffle, his knife blade snaps off in your leg. Whose knife blade is that now?
That's a good question.
No way later would that guy say, I need my knife blade back.
Right, exactly. Dude,
what would your response to that be?
Fair enough.
That knife blade would go in my shelf.
Absolutely.
And when people came over, I'd be like, see that knife blade?
But would you feel differently if in this fantastical world it was his finger that he had jabbed into your thigh,
yeah,
broken his finger.
His finger, and I would have it on my shelf. And when people came over and I caught them looking at it, I'd be like, "You see that?" And I would tell them about it.
I don't think it's a great comparison. I'm sorry. I think that's a horrible comparison. So the tine was in the animal or in the animal's antlers?
Oh, you know what? Because you missed. You, yeah,
right. It was in the animal, right? It was ingrained in the animal.
Yeah, so like
in the hide.
So right. There's buck A, like buck A and buck B.
Yeah.
They get in a fight, and buck A's antler ends up snapping off into buck B.
That's what I thought.
My buddy shoots A, who's missing its antler, and his buddy shoots B and finds embedded in its body. And the buddy keeps B buck.
No, I got all this.
Oh, you do? Oh,
yeah, like I thought maybe I wasn't explaining it.
No,
you've explained it. But my thing is, what is that buddy going to do with it? I mean, it's one thing. If it was wedged into the antler somewhere and it told the story, like what you're talking about, that makes sense. That's a piece of art. You know, you're putting the story up to mount on your wall. But it was ingrained in the shoulder. You can't just hang it on. That's like having a fish sculpture and hanging a fly out of
it.
It's got
some stupid chunk of antler laying
there. It's ridiculous. Give it to your buddy so he can super glue it onto his, you know, his mount.
Thought he should hang it from it in a deck with some decorative cord.
Oh, that's
cord.
No.
Just set it next to it.
Your guys' decor is a lot different, in my opinion. But okay, I don't think bringing a knife to it is necessarily the same analogy. A great analogy.
Okay, one more quick one, and then we're gonna talk about other stuff. I know how to really attack this one. Not long ago, we were talking about this. We were talking about that when you're sitting in a tree stand and it's cold out, and a big buck comes through, and you get all excited. And the big buck wanders off about his business unscathed. And then I personally all of a sudden feel like I'm cold. Like it left me, like I then I'm like, God, am I cold? And that guy's talking about how my brother, when he calls going off to take a growler, going off to take a heater. Right? A guy wrote in about a doctor writes in to explain these two things. He says, you have an autonomic nervous system of the human body and has two parts, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system releases epinephrine and other stress hormones to prepare for what is often referred to as fight or flight response. some of these things, would like effects of these hormones, increase heart rate, dilate pupils, vasoconstrict blood vessels. It shunts blood to the core vital organs. The skin becomes pale, cool, and diaphoretic. The vasoconstriction of peripheral vessels is why a person might feel cold after a stressful encounter with game animals. Tracking? On the other side, the parasympathetic nervous system is known as the rest and digest nervous system. The parasympathetic nervous system is active when the body is not under stress, i.e. eating, fornicating. Now, poor word choice on his part, because fornicating means having sex outside of marriage.
I didn't know that.
Yes. There could be...
Well, probably only if you're married.
Yeah, but I'm saying you could be having like some serious stressful... Let's say you a fellow was or a woman. Let's say a woman was married and the old man's off at work. I feel like right now he's got a little bit of bad word choice with fornicating, because he's saying when the body is not under stress, i.e. eating, fornicating. Eating, yes. Fornicating isn't just synonymous with lovemaking. Fornicating means marriage outside of, or sex outside of marriage. So a woman could be in a situation where she's, you know, like nervous about being discovered by her old man. You tracking? Which could make it stressful.
Which would then involve the other side of the nervous system.
Yeah. Which where there's like, you've got the fight and flight going on because you're foreign, you know. I think he should have said lovemaking, which is, make that just, that word just makes people uncomfortable. So the parasympathetic nervous system is active when the body is not under stress, i.e. eating, lovemaking, or in this case, pushing out a grumpy. The act of bearing down to defecate stimulates the vagus nerve, which is part of the parasympathetic nervous system. When the parasympathetic nervous system is stimulated, you get vasodilation to peripheral blood vessels, therefore increased blood flow to the skin, resulting in a warmer sensation. Therefore, bearing out my brother's observation that when he goes off in the woods on a cold morning to turn over a rock, so to speak, he feels warmed up by it all. That's all.
And can you confirm that you do feel cooler or colder when a big deer walks by?
And what's the difference? Where does adrenaline fall into all of this?
I think it's what he's saying is that the, when a big buck comes by, you get the adrenaline spike and then it drops and you're, that's when I become cold.
Right.
And I do feel that you get warmed up going off and rolling over a rock.
Definitely.
You guys have a lot of strange ways of saying taking a poop. I've heard three different ways in like 2 minutes.
Because
that's what you're saying, though, right?
Because you know, like the term I was saying earlier that makes people uncomfortable.
Growler
is that no what growler doesn't make you feel uncomfortable.
Lovemaking.
Oh, lovemaking. Yeah.
Yeah, going poop. It just sounds so personal.
I love it. I think it's great. Pooping sounds fantastic.
All right. We use that like that's what our what with our kids.
Pooping.
Yeah, they need to poop. They're pooping. It's just like I feel like it's very family term.
Well, it is.
But taking a growler is a hunting term.
Okay. Thank God. I'm enlightened. I've learned a lot so far. Oh, well, that's interesting. That's a very wordy way of saying, you know.
But I'm so happy that that's explained. It just like, it makes sense, right?
Chris, you seem like not engaged.
No,
by
I've been thinking about poop a lot this fall because I've been hunting Hungarian partridge a lot. So I'm just, you know, they, like a covey of partridge huns will roost together and they roost tails together.
Yeah.
So you, when you find their roost, you actually find this neat little pile of poop. And they're a tough to find bird. I have a great bird dog, but a lot of times you're just walking around looking for sign, which are these little white tip droppings. So yeah.
Quail do the same thing. Yeah. They come in, they back into each other and make a little circle,
right?
And make a little collective like poop group.
Yeah. No, I was not disinterested. I was lost in thought, you know, doing my poet thing.
How do we getting out of that? How best to get get to our subject matter at hand.
Well, I could tell you why I think Huns are the...
No, not that.
Oh, what is our subject
today? I want to talk about your book, of course, and bone fishing in general.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. I could tell you about how Huns are the bone fish of the prairie. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. Do that. Do that.
No, I have been thinking about them a lot this fall. And there is something to the seemingly mundane habitat that Huns live in. You know, grassy hillsides. They're mostly seed eaters. They don't need a whole lot of agriculture to survive. They're really hardy birds. And they covey up, they group up. A lot of times, you know, bonefish will school up as well.
You're doing a very good job, man.
For the most part, the reason why I enjoy traversing that wide, wide country, it reminds me of being on the flats. You know, there are these, what McGuane called these long silences, you know, between where you actually find a covey of birds when your dog goes on point. And that's usually, you know, right about when you think nothing's going to happen. And then suddenly
whammo.
It does. Yeah.
I shot some Huns one time, my late buddy Eric, that had their crops were full of grasshoppers.
Oh yeah. That's their chief food in the early fall. And then they go to cheatgrass after the hoppers, you know, die off for the, my buddy told me he found one, clean one last year, and the Hun had in its crop a grasshopper that was still kicking when he cleaned it.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah. It upsets me a little bit, but it doesn't surprise me.
For the
just like it'd be like a little bit startling, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Cleaning a bird and there's a live grasshopper in there. But no, I wouldn't feel bad for him. You guys have all, I imagine you've caught a whole pile of bonefish, right, April?
Yeah, I think I've caught a few.
Cal?
Never.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, I always kind of poo-pooed those things. I was like, caught a lot of whitefish in my day.
You can go if you got something else to do, because we thought you'd caught bonefish. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I've seen them. I took a couple of bad casts.
Oh, you did?
One time, yeah.
Yanni, you caught them.
A few, though. Only a few. 15 years ago, I was down in Belize for, I don't know, a couple weeks, and I maybe landed a half dozen.
Okay.
All right. Nice.
So your book, Chris.
Yes, Steven.
Explains how that fish went from being, it does a lot of things, but explains how the bonefish became a celebrity fish.
Right.
When it used to just be a what?
Well, they threw it into piles that went into making dog food. Back in the day, you know, the commercial netters would, if bonefish ended up in their catch, they would basically throw it into a pile that went to Purina or some other, you know, undesirable pile of fish, right? And that, the evolution of that is really what, as you say, the book is about, at least on the surface level. 1951 was when the first Bahamian bonefish lodge was erected. This guy named Chart.
51?
Yeah, 51.
See, I read the book, but I don't even remember being that early. Really? So people in 1951 were thinking, like, oh, this is a cool fish to catch.
Yeah, well, not very many people.
One,
there was
one guy.
One guy, a wealthy Floridian guy named Gil Drake, who had bonefish in the Keys. There were a few guys that had bonefish in the Keys. Now, most people, the kind of famed Bahamian bonefish guy is a guy named Crazy Charlie Smith. You know,
the Crazy Charlie fly.
Sure, is the fly everyone knows about. But
I got a small problem.
Yes.
What's the guy's name again? Because here's the guy. It got me thinking. The guy that shot the moose and got in trouble. Guess what his name is?
Gil Drake?
No, he's got the perfect. No, Rusty Counts. Yeah, Rusty Counts.
That sounds like a moose poacher.
Three counts of poaching.
Yeah.
Rusty Counts. Okay, so Gil Drake.
Okay, so Gil Drake in about 1951, I actually had to listen to this book on audiobook to remind myself of a few things.
Your own book?
Yeah, I hadn't read it in a couple years, so I had to reacquaint myself. But 51 sounds right. Gil Drake was this wealthy Floridian guy. He lived in Palm Beach, and his wife basically fronted him the money to go down to the Bahamas and build a lodge. And he, you know, the flight from Palm Beach to the east end of Grand Bahama is really 35, 40 minutes, right? So he found this at the far east end of the archipelago, this little island that was, that came to be called Deepwater Key. And after a few months of being down there, he hired a man named David Pinder, who he hired to basically clean the island of mangroves and help them lug rock and you know, rudimentary construction projects. But soon he found out that Pinder, who had been born and raised on this tiny little island, knew a lot about where the bonefish lived, right?
For what reason?
He grew up foraging. He was a shore forager. His father had been a sponger, you know, and had drifted kind of island to island to island. Pinder says in the book,
Sponger, like a guy that collects sponges, yeah, for the
sea sponge.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's not ornamental, right? That's for sponges.
No, they were selling them for sponges. Yeah. Pinder contends that sponges were over harvested at one point. And so, you know, he was basically a sponger's son who had spent an inordinate amount of time on this tiny little island at the east end of Grand Bahama. And so he knew where the bonefish lived. He was basically bemused when Drake said, "Do you think you could show us where to catch them?" Because of, you know, of what use was a bonefish, right? They were tedious to eat at best, you know, and there were snapper plentiful and lobsters and whatnot.
Yeah. So we talked about this. In Hawaii, they make a ground up patty.
Yeah.
And they call bonefish oyo.
They're not bad. I've eaten one.
Yeah, me too.
But regardless. But
one thing we got to do.
Yeah.
Someone needs to explain like what a bonefish is and where it lives.
I can do it.
Go for it.
All right. Well, so it's the bonefish is a sport fish now. It's really averages about 3 to 5 pounds. It's a fish that lives in deep water, looks to, you know, the Western eye or even the Midwestern eye like a whitefish. Basically, if you caught Lake Superior whitefish in Michigan or you caught Rocky Mountain whitefish, the bonefish looks very, very similar. It can travel at speeds of up to 30 miles an hour. So it's a super sporty fish when hooked, right?
Strong,
kind of straight ahead, laser sharp runs, not real, doesn't make a whole lot of buckle.
Like rockets. When you hook them, the line going through the water, I can't remember if I came up with this or somewhere else did. I don't know. Maybe I stole it from someone. That when that fish takes off and your line's caught in the water, it sounds like someone ripping newsprint.
Yeah, that is exactly what it sounds like. If you did steal that, that's a good theft. I actually, in the chapter where I'm kind of describing the physicality of the bonefish, I quote a bit from Meat Eater, the book. You have a great line where you say their nose looks like the working end of a rechargeable vacuum, I think. Is, yeah, what
it's got that same pitch to, yeah, it. Like those old, like your mom's vacuum, mm-hmm, your mom's, the kind of vacuum, like stick in the wall. What the hell are those?
Oh, I forget what those are called, but yeah.
Everybody knows what they look like.
Dust something, yeah.
Dustbuster,
yeah. Anyway, so they live, for the most part, in deep water where they're rarely caught, but they come onto the flats to feed. So the saltwater flats being ankle to knee deep, really, and exceptionally clear. They eat crabs, they eat shrimp, they eat little benthic worms, they eat sea urchins, they eat small perch, they even eat small bonefish. There's a great story in here where this old guy, David Pinder, yep, who I mentioned, just catches a bonefish that has a 12-pound bonefish that has a 1-pound bonefish, actually still alive in its belly.
It's the only fish you can, maybe not the only one, but one of very few fish you can track down.
Oh, sure, yeah, because they root.
Or like, not the yeah, that leave signs.
Right, they do.
They yeah, leave signs.
They leave muds.
Sure, they leave when muds.
Because they go up and go, mm-hmm, into the mud. and make a little looks like someone like kind of jammed a golf ball down into the ground and pulled it back out again.
Yep.
And you'd be like, oh, they've been through here.
Yeah, you'll see like dark gray patches. Yeah, they've got muds everywhere.
Yeah, and then yep. those little I don't know what you call it, the little divot.
Rootings, yeah.
Yeah, little rootings.
But they don't, you know, they don't jump. I think they are certainly fast, but they're probably best renowned for their speed, right? And their strength for their size.
Sure. And I think at the time when Gil Drake, this Floridian, was thinking he could make a fishing lodge based on this bonefish, it was their fickleness, you know, the difficulty of pursuit that kind of made them a target as a sport fish.
I'm assuming he never fished permit.
No, you know, he would have chanced upon them in the Keys.
Yeah.
His wife actually became his son's wife, Linda Drake, became an incredible Keys guide. In fact, Harrison used to fish with her. Do you recognize that name, Linda Drake?
No, but I'd like to.
Yeah, she also guided for this lodge where most of the book takes place, called Deepwater Key.
Oh, yeah, I've been to Deepwater Key.
Yeah, so anyway, this old man, David Pinder, started guiding basically for $5 a day in 51. Yeah.
$5 a day.
$5 a day, right? And he had been working at some kind of a missile detection site near Freeport, you know, making probably $5 a month. So $5 a day was this incredible raise for him and opportunity. And over the course of,
I gotta interrupt because there's a great story where he's like working there and he must just be doing hard labor too. And it's him and two other dudes. And that's when Drake comes up and he's looking for a strong, healthy worker. And he doesn't know anything about these three men except he's just sizing them up. And Pinder gets picked. And he's like, that was the day of all my days.
Yeah.
That was the moment.
That was when life changed.
Right. It's an amazing, it's a really a beautiful moment, I think. Mm-hmm. It was, I want to say it was whatever Ruination Day is, the same day the Titanic sank.
The Titanic sinking has a name?
Yeah, Ruination Day.
And it's based off the Titanic sinking?
Well, I had this argument with my editor, actually, because she said it was a Gillian Welch phrase or invention, but whatever. It's the same day.
Come on.
Same day Lincoln was assassinated, right? And the Titanic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, same. Anyway, so...
Man, the guy that shot Lincoln, what a nut job that guy was, man. I didn't realize until I recently was watching something that... I mean, you're obviously a nut job, right?
Oh, man.
But I mean, just like, you know, just kind of like a drunken derelict, you know? Total loser.
You can't believe it.
I mean, even besides like how bad you are to kill a man, let alone kill the president. But in addition, was just like a drunken...
Yeah,
derelict.
Just walked into the playhouse.
It's like a
right?
total dare, like mm-hmm. yeah, drunken theater guy. Go ahead though.
All right, I will. Let's see.
If anybody had any doubts as to whether or not the assassin,
like I could be like, now there's a fine specimen of a gentleman.
What'd you find?
Did you met? Yeah. So it's Abraham Lincoln's assassination, the Titanic sinking. And the Black Sunday dust storm of 1935.
Oh, wow. Adds up to Ruination Day.
Yeah. There you go.
And everybody's saying bad things happen in threes.
And then Gillian first brought attention to this historical confluence on her 2001 album, Time.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, remind me the guy that goes down and he opens the thing up to try to establish a fishery.
Right. Gil Drake.
Does he need to, because he's trying to take a fish that no one cares about and make people begin, or part of his job is to market the fish. He needs to like manufacture a clientele.
Yeah, but he's still decades really away ahead of himself as far as that's concerned. I mean, this is the 50s, so he's really just putting up a cool place for he and his buds to go hang out.
Okay.
Right.
So he thinks it's fun and doesn't care if you think it's fun or not.
Exactly. He's fronted, his wife's fronted him the money. He's going to go down and enjoy himself. And then the fishery kind of begins to take off. And some crazy things coincide timing-wise. So as the rise of fly fishing for bonefish starts to happen. We're also looking at the height of the Colombian drug cartel, right? So,
okay.
You know, Deepwater Key becomes this destination probably next to Charlie Smith's Bang Bang Club, the great Bahamian bonefish destination at the time, right?
What's Charlie Smith's Bang Bang Club?
That's over on Andros. That's over on Andros. And Charlie Smith is probably the real famed, if you ask people who started bonefishing, who was the first Bahamian bonefish guide, almost everybody will say Charlie Smith. They won't say David Pinder, who is at the center of this book and actually was the first guide, but there's really...
Pinder has, that's a generational family, right?
Because
I was guided by a Pinder when I was there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you might have been guided by William. You might have been guided by Joseph. His two sons, David Jr. and Jeffrey, guide up out of Freeport. They're all, you know, incredible. And then third generation is a guy named Miko Glinton, who's people know from his YouTube world and his, I mean, Miko's,
he's the showboat, right?
He is the showboat.
I think he and I fished. Yeah, we fished for a day and he would do this, like, he does the Michael Jackson turn.
Yes,
yeah,
he does.
He'll do a cast and in between casts, he'll do this, you know, Michael Jackson turn on the bow of the boat and complete his cast. Yeah.
Lines in the air.
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. He can throw the whole line with just his hands, you know? So, Miko is third generation and, you know, the book, I'm getting ahead of myself, but if we go back to the 70s, Gil Drake's son comes around, becomes this also a great young guide in the area. And the bonefish is like a viable sport fish now. Suddenly people are traveling to the Bahamas to, you know, catch this fish, right? Meantime, the Bahamian economy is in the tank, right?
We're just getting into the drug cartels.
Yeah, so we're still, some people like Prime Minister Lyndon Pindling are getting exceptionally rich, you know, taking bribes from the cartel, but everybody else is floundering. And about that time, someone discovers that the bonefish is the reason people are coming to, you know, they didn't use the term ecotourism back then, but... someone had the good sense to say, look, we can keep giving the Colombians all this money or all this, you know, play in the islands, or we can kick them out all together and see if our economy can actually be based on this fish. So as it would turn out in 2010, that same fish that Pinder guided toward for $5 a day in the 50s, the bonefish is $151 million industry tourism wise per year in the Bahamas.
So in the Bahamas alone.
It's in the Bahamas alone. So it's, and that's, you know, 800,000 people, maybe 900,000 now, but it's the crux of their ecotourism industry.
And what's one day of flats fishing out there right now?
I want to say it's $795 now, maybe per 700. Day. There's a friend of mine who did
Costs to go fish. That's what it costs to go up and stay at a lodge and fish in Alaska.
Right. BC is similar?
It's on par with the rest of the lodges. They do a lot of, you know, week-long packages, so it's great for the entire economy there.
Yeah.
Can you still do... Like, I don't know why you wouldn't be able to. Like, in 1996...
Oh.
In 96, me and my brother flew to Cancun, took a bus to Playa del Carmen, and then bought shitloads of beans and rice and a bunch of water and just walked and slept on the beach and fished bonefish. And you'd like now and then run into a dude who was doing it, but it wasn't like a thing people were doing.
Oh, just DIY on the beach?
Yeah.
Yeah,
for a month.
The Bahamians complicated that a couple years ago. I mean, you could still do it in Mexico. You can still do it in Belize.
Yes, Belize is where my buddies do it.
Yeah. Sure. So if we take that $5 a day in the 50s and we compare it to the $795 per guide day today.
$795.
$795 per day. According to this econ guy that I talked to, nothing but gold has appreciated more in that span of time. So you take this fish that was basically thrown away, discarded into piles for dog food, whatnot. And it literally becomes the crux of this whole country's economy. Gets them out from under the drug cartels, the shadow of the drug cartel. And really, now that we're talking a third generation of Bahamian guides, helps a country become self-sufficient. This guy, Prescott Smith, who's, go ahead.
You can take this on later if you want. Is the money flowing to Bahamians or is it all flowing to Americans?
Good question, because—
Take that out when you want.
Well, I'll take it on now. It's about where I was going to go. So Prescott Smith is the son of Charlie Smith, the crazy Charlie guy, right? And what's Prescott—
Is he a Bohemian? Or?
He's a Bohemian, yep. Okay. And he—
Bohemian?
Bohemian.
That's funny. A lot of people—
I didn't want to be the one to say it. Yeah. I was Oliver White recently corrected me. I said, oh, is your wife Bohemian? He said, Bohemian. I've been saying it wrong.
Right. It is. It's easy to confuse it to you. In fact, when I was working on this book, I must have said Bohemian a few times and people thought, like, God, this guy, I knew this guy was weird, but I didn't think he was that weird to write a book about Bohemians. Bohemians. You know.
What was your question, Yanni?
Sorry, Yannis.
I missed the whole damn question.
If Crazy Charlie was a local.
Yeah, so Crazy Charlie, he has a famous lodge over on Andros, and his son, Prescott, has become the voice of this second, third generation of guides, basically saying, we have to get these lodges out from under the ownership of these wealthy Floridian dudes or wherever they're from. And we need to own these lodges, because only if we own them will the conservation be, the necessary choices in conservation be made, right? He talks—
That's a bold statement.
It is, man. And he's a hated dude in a lot of ways. You asked about the can you just get a bag of beans and rice and go kind of dirt bag it. In the last couple of years, the Bahamas passed a law that basically said you can't do that anymore.
No, see, that's new. When I was in the Bahamas, I mean, I did a lot of DIY. I knew that when I was going there, you still couldn't guide there as an, if you weren't from there, but you could do it yourself. So they've changed that in the last few years.
My brother breaks the law down. I shouldn't say this.
Well, that's the thing. It's not, I was actually down there. We went down as a family to celebrate the book with this whole town, this little town of maybe 300 people, is called McLeanstown, and that's where David Pinder lives. We went down to celebrate the publication of it, and I wanted to take Luca, our son, bone fishing. So I had to get him a license, but no one thought you needed to have a license. They thought the old rules were still in place. So to find the actual license is a classic hijinks of, like, you know, island time. Well, you should go over and see Steve. Well, Steve told me to go over and see April, you know, blah, blah, blah. So no one appears to be monitoring it. But
yeah, we had an argument in the Bahamas. I don't want to say where, because it's kind of not a place not many people go to. We had an argument in the Bahamas with the guy we were renting a house from, where he was insulted when we suggested the need for a fishing license, and was especially insulted when we mentioned that there is distances from the land where you cannot spearfish. Huh. And he's like, not that he didn't like the law, was like insulted that we would be so stupid as to bring up the idea that someone could possibly even make a law.
Yes. I had the same conversation with a gentleman who thought that going to try to buy a license was the stupidest thing. But, you know.
And he's like, you're telling me that there's no way it could be true that you can't. You spearfish where you want, man.
That's great. Anyway, so Prescott Smith has become a kind of a controversial figure. But what he talks a lot about conservation-wise, the Bahamian archipelago is a fascinating geological specimen, if you will, right? If you want to forego your Ambien tonight, just pick up a book on Bahamian geology. It's a real sleeper, but every—
There's
nothing
like, happens?
No, but every like 500 pages or something, you discover some really cool things. For one, slavery didn't really take in the Bahamas. The Bahamas had a way different narrative in terms of colonialism than most of the Caribbean.
Culturally, or wasn't suitable ground to grow cane?
Both, but the latter for the most part. So for the same reason that cane didn't grow there, the limestone, right? We get this thing called a freshwater lens. So obviously the islands exist in salt water, but rain falls onto limestone and basically percolates through the tiny holes in limestone and then spreads out and makes what's called a freshwater lens. It's like a meniscus of freshwater that allow the mangroves to flourish.
Floats on top of the salt water.
It floats on top of it, yep.
Is that why when we were catching baby tarpon, they were saying it was, I mean, I knew it was brackish.
Yeah, that's exactly why.
I was wondering how they could have brackish water in that area. So that's how.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense until you see this gigantic map of, so Prescott Smith is a huge proponent of preserving these freshwater lenses because they are the places where mangroves can flourish. And if you can get mangroves to flourish, you can get, you know, the bait fish to flourish, the lobsters, which they commercially fish for, to flourish, all of these things. When that freshwater lens is destroyed, basically, according to Prescott, and really this other biologist named Andy Danilchuk, who works at UMass. Do you know
Andy
him?
Really yeah. Well, yeah.
So he was, you know, a great contact.
That study that they did, there he and his wife, right?
Yeah.
They did that incredible study.
Right. I mean, he's probably one of the people I talked to scientifically the most while working on this book.
And he helped establish, you know, the value of these. I read the whole paper. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It's
you should
really
start saying body of water instead of the book so it burns into people's heads.
Thank you.
What the name of the story is.
Body of water.
Can I two things about the freshwater lens.
Body of water.
I have often, in body of water, you mentioned the freshwater lens. Dude, I spent a lot of time puzzling over how in the hell, like, let's say you see a little island and it's got mangroves on it, but there's no fresh water. There's no pond. There's no creek. I've often been like, how in the world does that thing survive?
That's what I'm wondering. So is that a lens there?
It's possible that there is one, but mangroves are really like the most hardy plant you'll ever come across. I mean, they can live basically underwater. Their roots poke up and kind of snorkel for air. You know, they can store salt water and shed it basically through dead leaves. So they're an incredible survivor. I don't know the, you know, direct answer to that question, but I would say the kind of tenacity of mangroves has something to do with it.
But can they collect all their fresh water from just the simple rain?
I think so.
It's got to be that, right? Mm-hmm.
The second point is, you talk about salt water, how fresh water float on salt water. I dove in a body of water in the Philippines where there are freshwater species and then you dive down and there are saltwater species because it's like, it's a freshwater lake that has an outlet, like a cave entrance that leads out into the ocean.
Right.
And so there's these like cichlids that are up in the freshwater portion, but then down in the saltwater portion, you'll run into barracuda and other stuff that come in and out of
that. That is awesome.
So you can dive down through and the temperature change is unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
Do they have blue holes down there?
It was one of those. It was, they didn't call it that, but it was like a blue hole setup.
Right. There's a few of those around.
And somehow these freshwater fish got established in that. These freshwater fish somehow got established in there and formed like a little population. You dive down, the water's warm, and you dive down in there, and all of a sudden the water's like frigid. And it was that open ocean salt water, but that somehow that body of water, huh?
Nice.
Fresh
nice,
water
nice.
On top of there.
Good.
But go on.
Well, so I mean, if you imagine this table here is an island in the Bahamas. Whenever a piece of ground is developed and infrastructure is put in, they basically have to cut into that limestone. And when they do that, they destroy that freshwater lens. So if you look at places like Exuma, where the fishery's kind of been destroyed by resorts and such, that's what guys like Prescott Smith are trying to stop from happening and really are loud in the guiding community because they want to take this Bahamian resource and keep it a Bahamian resource. They don't want, you know, what has happened for generations. Someone comes in, builds something, messes something up, leaves it, goes somewhere else, messes something up. You know, they don't want that same process but to happen over.
Are bone fishing resorts doing that level of development? Like, when I think of a bone fishing place, I think of them being real chill.
Well, how long does it take for that? So when you dig up the flats bottom, I mean, I heard it takes an astronomical amount of time for it to get all of its nutrients back.
That's right, yeah.
How long does it take to do that?
Well, I mean, I would say exponentially longer than it takes to destroy it. So a little tiny island like Deepwater Key, sorry, that's like a 2 square mile island, I think, you know, they proposed the economic well-being of the island is it was for a long time owned by a guy that, you know, we talked about this, but
own the island,
and they proposed putting in, I think, 100 houses. So that would do it. I mean, that would 100 houses would on a 2 mile island basically damage significantly that habitat nearest the island. Now,
Everyone wants a dock. And if you look at the damage that all of those docks do, it is unbelievable. And then you get the outboard. You ever seen all the scrapes?
Mm-hmm.
The,
oh, yeah, man.
It's a mess.
Yeah, especially when you're flying over that kind of, when you're flying over those flats, you see all those engine scars on it.
And those take forever to repair, I saw recently.
So the guys that want to build a house, they want to do like a golf course model.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
Like you come down, but instead of to play golf, you fish bonefish.
Right. I mean, the notion that a small island could support kind of an ocean reef club sized development is crazy, but over and over and over, the management of this small island changed hands, and as it changed hands, suddenly somebody needed to make more money in the endeavor than the last guy did, right? And so essentially, as we find it in the book, Body of Water,
good job.
The island itself is at an impasse, and the community is about to be damaged by what might transpire, right? So David Pinder, who was the original guide, he goes basically through, he becomes famous, if you will, as a guide. He guides like AJ McLean and Joe Brooks and all the famed, you know, magazine stars of the day. And they come down and they write about him. And he makes Deepwater Key what it is, the great destination of Bahamian bonefish lodges. But there's kind of a caveat as he's working all these decades, he's not wearing polarized glasses. So he's developing severe cataracts on his eyes. And as the lodge itself grows kind of into fame, his sight declines and he's eventually, you know, shit canned by the lodge and given a severance of, I want to say $18,000 is the amount they gave him for 40 or so years of service, which,
that's a severance package.
That was, you know, an extra $1.25 a day, basically.
We should point out here that that these fish, and you can talk about this as well, the preferred way of catching them is to see them.
Yes.
Them, stalk them, and cast them. I mean, I've caught them out just like dicking around too.
Right.
But
yeah, if you're blind
one's vision, I'm just saying eyesight is quite important.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, apparently, Pinder was so skilled at finding these fish that one lodge owner said he hears the fish, he doesn't need to see them. But
yeah,
you know,
there's a knack to it for sure, man. There's
right,
like, spotting fish, it's huge.
Yeah,
talent.
There's like people you can be like, no, right there, no, right there. It's like spotting mule deer.
But it's not the preferred. I just want to say, like, it's not the, as fly fishermen too, people, you know, think we're just trying to make it harder. It's not the preferred method. It's the most efficient method. So if you could blind cast all day, and don't get me wrong, when you find a whole school of bonefish and they're mudding up, you can cast into that enormous mess of fish and you'll catch a bunch of little.
I mean,
ones.
Catch them out of channels. Because they travel the channels.
Yeah, but you know, you're going to be blind casting all day long. You're going to be much more productive if you start pulling the flats and you're sighting them. And
then
you
can preferred
because it's more productive.
Because it's the most effective.
No, because if I said it's more productive to blow them up with dynamite, that doesn't mean you're going to blow them up with dynamite.
I would actually argue that it's still more productive to fly fish for them than blowing them up with dynamite.
Okay.
No. He's like, no.
No, I disagree. The fishery is what it is because people want to go down and sight fish for the fish. They're not like, yeah. I want to catch a bonefish and I don't care if I'm out in 100 feet of water with a pound of lead and a live shrimp. They're not. They want to come down and they want to see that fish.
Sure. Preferably.
If you were elk hunting.
They prefer
damn it.
To come down and see that fish and stalk that fish and present a yeah. fly, whatever, 4 feet off the end of its nose, sure. whereas you're not going to scare the shit out of it and have it pick it up. Like, that's the thing.
If
that's
you were like, elk hunting and I it was a tough day, you know, and I said, I'm going to give you a heat-seeking bullet and you can safely shoot it onto that mountainside and it will find, you know, the shoulder.
I like to think I wouldn't do it.
I know.
Right? How big we talking?
Is it a big bowl? Is it a big, huge bowl? Yeah. So yeah, my only point, I mean to derail the conversation, no, but I was just saying like when the dude loses his right. eyesight wanes, you're kind of
his eyesight out wanes, of the game, but man. His eyesight wanes according to the ownership of this lodge. And this is the, you know, this is the point in the book where he becomes kind of that, you know, the classic archetypal figure that was cast aside, right? He helped basically, he literally built the place with his hands. And then when he becomes a little less useful, he's cast aside. So he takes on a little bit of this mythic quality. And as I would discover, he actually, he didn't lose his sight altogether. We fished together quite a few times and he was just as good at spotting bonefish as you or I would be.
Because he could hear them.
Well, I don't know. He could sense them somehow. Or his eyes healed up. He got cataract surgery and didn't tell anyone. You know, there are a few kind of mysterious missing pieces in the narrative. Not missing because I didn't research them, but missing because I got different answers from, you know, different yeah. people.
What even brought you down there in the first place? Were you trying to work down there?
No, my original trip down there was on a how to or a where to piece for, you know, Outside Magazine. And I had an old client. I'm sure you, how long have you been guiding or were you guiding before you?
I guided 10 years.
10 years.
15 years.
So
ago.
You probably have a large group of people you would consider your friends, right?
That from
you,
my clientele.
Yeah, from your clientele.
For sure.
So I had this awesome client, a guy named Jeff Miller, who grew up in St. Louis and had fished at Deepwater Key from the late 70s, early 80s. And when I went down there, he said, you got to meet this guy, David Pinder. He's the guy that started it all. If you really want to write about bone fishing in the Bahamas, you need to know David Pinder. Of course, you know, I went down with the hopes of dashing off an article and fishing the rest of the time myself, right? But on subsequent trips, I would bring groups of clients down. On subsequent trips, I met Pinder and spent a lot more time with him and realized that he was one of those kind of singular dudes. I mean, a person who has spent his entire life on a 2 mile island. I mean, he grew up foraging for snails and crabs and whatever he could find. Lived on the same plot of land yeah. that entire time. So the more time I spend down there, the more time I realize that he was the subject of whatever this book might be. And
when you say you brought people down, you were a promoter?
No, I was a host. I just hosted a group of my clients who wanted to go down and bonefish at this lodge.
What's that relationship look like?
It looks good if you get it for free. I mean,
and plus your 15%.
Yeah, so if you get 8 people, then you get to go for free and they cut you a check for whatever the...
Yeah, April, you used to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. But I also... I've done trips to the Bahamas and Belize and...
Like, you organize it.
Yeah, and I'd get a 15% check, but I also would sit there and I wouldn't fish. And
a
I'd,
commission.
Yeah, that's right. But I would host these trips, and unless my client caught a permit, for example, I'd be sitting on the boat being like, oh my God. Yeah. And I don't know about you, but my clients are great steelhead fishermen. They're not all great in a flats boat. So I did a lot of just sitting and watching.
Yeah.
Well, hold on, what do you mean? You'd be like anxious about them being successful.
Well, I couldn't catch a fish. Professionally, I didn't feel comfortable fishing until my clients had caught a fish.
I see.
I mean, there are two different kinds of hosts. There are some hosts that don't have that same consideration. I felt it would be a professional courtesy to take a back seat.
What are they asking of you though?
To talk to them and just give them advice.
So these would be people like in your case. you guide steelhead clients. You become professional friendly with the clients. And they say, man, I would love to go fish bonefish, but I'm not comfortable just going down there and cold rolling in.
Yeah, and I go, I would
like you
it.
To be
my host.
So that I have a familiar face when I arrive.
Yeah, and when we arrange everything. Okay. Right, so
right, it's not even, so April is going, I'm going to make sure we're going with the right operation. They got the right boats. We're going to be set up for success.
We're going to make sure that we got an in with the right tides and the right, you know, guides.
And when something goes wrong, it's kind of on you.
Kind of, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And you've been there before, right? You sussed it out. You know how to get from the plane to the shuttle to the lodge and all that.
Have you done this, Giannis?
Mm-mm.
It's something I no longer do. I find it really exhausting. It's a lot of work.
Like a long week.
Yeah. And well, it depends. I mean, a lot of my clients are amazing and for their friends, you know, it's a great time, but you still have to be on. And I don't know. Did you take a back seat?
No, it's not.
You didn't like it either?
No.
I wouldn't
do
it again.
So it's not a great business.
No, I wouldn't do it again.
How many times did you do it?
A lot, enough.
A dozen?
Yeah.
You?
No, half a dozen.
I think as a young fly fishing guide, though, boy, it was something you dreamed about, man.
To get to that point.
Oh, yeah. You'd hear like senior guides talking about doing these trips. And you're like, that sounds like paradise.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But you end up, you know, your commission gets put towards airfare and stuff. And yeah, you don't make any money off of it. And you get to a point as you get older, I think, where you're like, I would rather pay to not have to take a back seat.
Sure. Yeah. By the time I stopped doing it, our family was growing. I didn't want to be gone from the family. At its best, it's a free week of fishing. I think.
At its best.
Right.
Yeah.
So just so I'm understanding the business right, it's more of a way, because like guiding, I appreciate that guiding can be lucrative, but I gather from the guides I know that it's like a bootstrap.
It's seasonal.
Yeah. It can be a tough way to make a living.
Yes.
Just did you see my 2002 Sequoia out there? Is that what you're saying?
No. I wasn't referring to anyone's particular thing. But my sense of it is that as a guide, it's like a great lifestyle that people want to do. But when it comes, it's not like, you know, there's a lot of guides out there that aren't minting money.
No.
So is the hosting, just so I'm understanding the business right, the hosting is the thing you do because you want to go down in your position. I would love to go down. No way I'm going to spend the money on that. Mm-hmm. All I need to do to make it that I can go is to assemble this trip.
Usually I can't afford to pay that money to go on that trip.
What I'll do to make it happen.
There are a number of booking agencies agencies that's their whole business, right?
Their entire business.
Yeah. It's also
Yellow Dog here
something
in Montana.
That's like, it's another service that you can provide to your stable of clients that keeps them hanging out with you.
Gotcha.
Also, right?
Have and so like,
hey, I mean, I've done it on the hunt side. And I mean, really Giannis is doing something very, very similar every time he sets up a meat eater shoot. Right.
Yeah.
And you get a taste of it when you invite somebody out to hunt with you. And there's that kind of like gnawing feeling in the back of your head where you're like, I know I shouldn't feel this way, but I really want these guys to have success. I hope everything goes well this trip. I hope we at least see something that's not just a total goat rope the whole time.
Yeah. Goat rope.
The difference is if you bring one guest on the show, you have to deal with one person. But if you have 10 guests, there's usually a sour apple in there somewhere. So it can make things interesting.
Yeah, the lodge, the post-fishing lodge dynamic does not
always
show people at their best, you know.
Yeah.
April caught a 12-pounder. My biggest fish was 5. Cal caught a permit. What? Everyone's disappointed. Did you see any permit? It turns into pretty much drivel pretty quickly, I think.
Or even, I wish they would have told me to bring that fly.
Oh, right.
You know, and you're like,
Or why is the host always getting the best guides? That's a big one too.
Yeah.
I've heard nightmare stories about different hosts.
Yeah.
There's some great hosts and there's some real shitty hosts out there, as we all know.
Yeah.
I won't mention them, but yeah, there's some shitty ones. They're just selfishly trying to get that free trip. But there are other hosts who really care about your quality experience. And a lot of people who host trips own fly shops. So for them, it's an opportunity for them to sell gear, right?
Right. Oh, no shit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Man, such a neat little business you guys all got involved in. There's a word, you know, you're talking about like a
I think he almost said scam.
A guest? No, no. I was going to name, I want to name my daughter after my mother, but I wanted to name my daughter Zinnia. And Zinnia is a word, it's a word that has to do with the guest-host bond, the bond that forms between a guest and the host. And I believe it's somehow related to or comes from the action of a flower and a pollinator. Point being, I'm interested in this guest host situation.
Don't get too interested. It's really not that great. It's really I promise you.
No, it's really not. So it was a way for me to get down, to get back down there.
You know? I had a good buddy who he kind of was a fixer of sorts for destination lodges, right? And you could hire him and he would go hang out at your lodge and help kind of ferret out the usual crap that happens at those things, right? A little bit of theft, a little bit of like not, you know, taking cash under the table instead of running it through the books type of stuff. And he had quite the experience out there in the Bahamas and just taught. Part of the deal is like, I could take a boat out and go fish. But I didn't get to enjoy any of it because there was so much animosity between me, the white dude, right, and the staff,
right?
The local guides. And he said the friction was like nothing he had ever experienced. But that's really what it was. It was during that time of like, hey, we got to make sure that we control this industry and because nobody's going to take care of it the way we want it to be taken care of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that I saw that dynamic at work too. And I think, you know, it's funny you bring that up. Of all the things that reviewers talked about in regard to this book, Body of Water, no one would touch race, you know, even though it's definitely a subject in the book.
So you write about race, but the reviewers didn't want to talk about how it talks about race?
Even sitting here right now, I don't want to talk about it. I mean, Giannis I've got stories. Right? I've got stories for days, but I'm just like, nope, I'm going to leave that right now.
I got more. Tell me about, I mean.
Okay, well, I mean.
It's not surprising to me to hear that there's a little racial tension between...
Well, there is in every recreational economy. And it's not like necessarily black, white, brown, white, whatever. It's you're from here, you're not from here. And even though I'm making my living off of this industry, it is totally, totally hyper-focused on people not from here.
Yeah, come open a lodge in BC as an American and you're going to feel it. It's got nothing to do with color.
So it's more insider, outsider, but it happens to be overlaid with race rather than being black versus white.
Right. I mean, according to Prescott Smith, the guy I mentioned earlier, he says it's different really island to island. He says, you know, on Andros, race relations are far more evolved than they are on, say, the east end of Grand Bahama, which I would gather after spending a lot of time there is a lot more in the wilderness, if you will, right? But
that kind of racial tension, though, man, it does. There's a lot of it in Hawaii,
right?
And there's an inside. It's insider outsider, but it's also not, because look at the, like the derogatory term for an outsider. Is like a howley,
right?
So ghost, you presume like white, ghost-like.
Sure.
So like it's us, them, we, they, inside, outside, but it's overlaid by racial shit.
Right. So there's a moment in the book, it's probably 2/3 of the way through, there's this guy, Walter Reckley, who's guiding me on a given day. And Walter did an interesting thing after guiding for this prestigious lodge, Deepwater Key, for 25 years or so. He, along with another local guide from McLeanstown, got together with a couple investors and said, we want to build our own lodge. Will you front us the money for this? And the investors who had fished with them for 30 years or so said, yeah, let's do it. You know, we'll build it across the channel from Deepwater Key. It'll be within eyeshot, and it won't have its own island, but you know, you'll have your own boats, you'll have your own dock, everything. And, this is a place called East End Lodge, which is still in existence and still like Yellow Dog takes people down there. But for a couple years, it was floundering. And so Walter had to go back to work for the lodge that he had turned his back on. And of course, you know, fall in at the bottom of the totem pole. So we're sitting at lunch one day and we're talking about this. And I'm trying to dig a little bit out of him from a research standpoint. You know, I kind of play this conspicuous role in the book. Am I a poet? Am I a fishing guide? Am I a nonfiction writer? What am I doing down here? But he finally caves and says, like, how would you feel? He says, how would you feel if, where are you from again? Manitoba? That's what he says. And I say Montana. And he says, well, how would you feel if someone opened up a lodge in Montana, or if you worked for a lodge and you worked your entire life, but you could never own the boats, you could never own the equipment, you could never really get ahead, right? And that's a moment in the book where I, an epiphany, if you will, where I begin to see far deeper into the lens of these local Bahamians, because it's, the answer is obvious, right? You feel like shit.
I understand exactly where they're coming from. Look at Belize now compared to what it used to be when, you know, you Americans went and bought up everything. Mm-hmm. Or San Pedro, right?
Like,
yeah, you guys, you too. You too are the culprits. But yeah, I get where they're coming from. I mean, it's a limited resource.
Do you see this up in BC? I mean, BC is a lot more controlled in some ways, right?
It is. But yeah, there's always going to be that little bit of, I mean, you can be an American and have a lodge, but we want to see that you've put your time into, you know, be one of us. Because it just is like, why are you here taking from the resource? And what are you giving back? That's the big question. What are you giving back?
So that's, you know, the same question this guy Prescott Smith asked, same question Walter asks. All right, so by the end of the book, we...
Body of water.
We nice. See this lodge called North Riding Point, also kind of an old, prestigious lodge in the Bahamas, which becomes managed by this guy named Paul Adams, who had grown up on Deepwater Key, had grown up with David Pinder as a friend, as a mentor. His parents had managed the lodge, and then he goes off to prep school and college, whatever, ends up back at this lodge called North Riding Point. Their model is far different. They want, we talked about Miko earlier, Miko Glinton. They hired Miko away from Deepwater Key and said, we want to groom you to be the manager of this place. In the meantime, we're going to send your three kids to school, private school in Freeport. We're going to give your wife a job as assistant manager. Samantha is also a masseuse, you know. And so that old kind of antiquated post-colonial model that Deepwater Key had been following for so long is beginning to be usurped, if you will, or bettered by some newer lodges. So they're giving back, even though the money's presumably coming from somewhere up here. I don't know exactly.
What makes it tricky is that the industry is driven by outsiders, right?
Right.
It's like, it's not like there's this economy going on and then outsiders come in and they're like, oh, what a cute thing you've created here. We're going to grab it from you. It's like, well, no shit. There's a lot of outside interest in the economics of it because it's fueled by outside interest. If it wasn't for outsiders coming to fish, those jobs wouldn't exist. So what? It's not as clean, right?
Right, but I mean, eventually, it's the same discussion we're having here in Montana. What is sustainable and what isn't, right? Mm-hmm. What is erecting 50 or 100 houses on a 2-mile island sustainable to the environment? Probably not. Could this economy support it? Probably not. Would people continue to go there after years and years? No. So you'd end up with something that's not sustainable.
Yeah. And
so.
Does it, and it's one of those things that, yeah, you have the cliche, like loving something to death.
Right.
Yeah. It's one of those things that in pursuit of an ideal, you wreck the entire
right.
point. You wreck the entire point of it all.
I mean, I see the statistics in Montana. The outdoor recreation industry is bringing in billions, literally billions of dollars. $7.1 billion is the last stat that I saw. And outfitting and guiding is third in the outdoor rec tier of things, lot behind lodging and gas. So we're also contributing to those as well. But yeah, there's a breaking point for sure, I think.
And these are good examples, right? It's like, you know, it's like, well, I was in Belize when it was really good and it wasn't bought up, and so I don't even want to go there anymore.
Right.
So then you move on to the next spot and ruin that, like sure. You said before.
Do
right?
you guys so. Get any of that? Like when you go around, you're kind of rolling loud at this point, right? I mean,
man, we try to roll real quiet, and we typically do roll real quiet. And if we don't roll real quiet, it's not good.
Right. So people,
we try to be discreet, man.
Right.
People don't know we're somewhere unless they hear it from a neighbor.
Until the episode airs.
Yeah.
And then do you hear it?
We
kind of blew up a place. Is that what you're getting at?
No, I'm not accusing you of that. I'm just saying, like, I mean, when you go and do like that amazing caribou hunt, mm-hmm. you know, where you see that 50-mile string of caribou coming through, are your email inboxes getting lit up every week? Like,
you want to know the thing that we get asked about most? We get asked by a factor of 10. We get asked most about a particular antelope unit.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some things are self-limiting, okay, because of inaccessibility, because of needing to like draw like limited entry permit lotteries for tags, right? Where there's only a set number of participants that can engage anyways because they have a cap. You could be caribou hunting in a place that has a quota. So it's the quota gets filled every year.
Got it.
Right? You could blow it up in that you make it participation become harder because there's increased interest. And so therefore getting one of those permits becomes more difficult. But in a lot of places, including the place that we would never in a million years divulge, the antelope unit we would never divulge, you can't blow it up because there's that limiting thing. There's going to be set number of people are engaged in the activity every year, and that's capped by law. Other things, yeah, you could blow it up. And I think that happens to some extent, but I think that a lot of the people that watch the show are like honestly just interested in seeing the experience. And a lot of it's not something that a ton of people really want to go do always. In cases where we are upfront about it, sure, I have absolutely no doubt that it does a negative to it. And there's all kinds of arguments to be made about to the extent that awareness and advocacy and people's engagement with the resources is beneficial.
It's right? got it is. I and think 100%
really,
right.
Yeah, there's yeah. two really good arguments. There's two really good arguments, and I can articulate them both. And I vacillate between the two. And the one is that there's this great stuff out there. I don't want anyone to know about it. I just want it for me. And the other argument is that mindset will sink you in the end.
Right. We just had this discussion earlier today. Yeah, it's a balancing act.
Yeah, my old boss, this guy Rusty Gates, he owned a lodge on the Osabal up in Grayling, Michigan, and was one of the first fierce conservationists in that area.
Not a lot of them.
No, he fought off like Nestle and some big oil wells from going in, and he amassed this group of doctors and lawyers who were his clientele and basically said, look, they're going to screw this river up if we don't fight them. And so he started this thing called the Anglers of the Osabal. But
you say, in fact, I quit throwing my refrigerators and old washing machines in there.
Exactly. But I remember when I started bird hunting, he said, you know, CD, that's not a sport you want to get too many people into. So there is that feeling. But I read an amazing book. I was asked to write a blurb for an amazing book by a writer named Dean Kuypers called The Deer Camp, which takes place in Michigan. And Kuypers, he wrote for Spin Magazine forever and has written a lot of kind of environmental justice pieces. But he talks a lot about Aldo Leopold's philosophy and basically that notion that I'm going to read this note I wrote. He says something like, we can be ethical only in relation to something we can see, feel, understand, or otherwise have faith in, you know? So that idea that yeah, you want to keep something to yourself, but if you keep it really all to yourself, the next generation ceases to have the ability to that direct contact, you know, that thing that inspires stewardship and conservation and whatnot.
And that's the razor's edge that you walk, right? It's, I want to influence people, and you got a book like Body of Water here that's going to be very influential to who reads it, but you want to inspire folks just enough to where if they get asked if, hey, just by chance, would you care if we ended fishing in the state of Montana? They'd be like, boy, you know, I don't fish there personally, but I don't think that's a good idea. Right?
Right. Yeah.
But you don't necessarily want them out there on the on the river you either. Yeah. Right?
So. You no doubt know the fishing writer, John Gierick.
Yeah.
And then his, he's got a fly tying buddy, AK Best.
AK Best, sure.
No, it wasn't AK Best that said it. Yanni, who's the guy that had the quote about, what are you doing over there?
Texting Brody.
You know what? I'll bring this. I'll help you sell people on why you're doing that, and I'll bring it full circle and say Brody's a fishing guide too.
That's right.
In Colorado.
And he used to do quite a few of these hosted trips.
Oh, so, okay, so I'm just keeping your little side activity and making it seem like it's in.
I have many side activities going during these conversations.
Help me out though. It wasn't AK Best who said the role casting quote that I'm going to quote.
Yeah, we even asked John about this, didn't we?
Some fishing writer whom John Gierick admires was saying, I won't write about any river that I can roll cast across, and roll cast a long ways.
I think that's a really, really great rule.
That's awesome.
Sure, it's okay to write about the Missouri. It's like bigger than I-90, right?
Yeah, what are you gonna like? You can keep that secret.
Yeah,
yeah. This Missouri you speak of, but in Body Water, right? You're walking the line, dude.
Absolutely.
Because there's no doubt. Like I read it. I've done that. I've fly fished for bonefish in Mexico. I fly fished for bonefish in Belize. I fly fished for bonefish in the Bahamas. Okay, but kind of like, whatever. Did it. Moved on to other things. But reading it, I'm like, damn, that is pretty cool, man. I do. It's like, makes me want to go back because you write about it. We haven't talked about this, but you write about it very beautifully. I can see you struggle as a poet and a writer because you're trying to mix, you're putting a poetic sensibility into certain passages, but also there's a journalist sensibility. And those two things are not always dancing nice.
No.
They're not always like dancing nice.
No.
They're dirty dancing. They're dancing dirty. But the point, let me finish this thing and then take the writing on. But I just want to finish the point here. You're sending people down there by writing beautifully about a place that you feel could potentially be destroyed by people going down there.
I know.
You're setting up a real conundrum.
It's the thin edge of the wedge, right? Yeah, I know. A place like Deepwater Key has been developed to the extent that it can be developed. And it sounds like the money was pulled. No one's going to be able to build 50 houses anymore. That's kind of a pipe dream.
Okay.
But I do think about that. I've never written one fishing piece on Montana that even remotely refers to a body of water that you could locate. In fact, I try to obscure it as best as possible, right? I try to... Super cute.
Oh my God, I would love.
I'll obscure it as best possible. Hunting pieces in the same way. But back to your notion of that kind of poeticized journalism or whatnot. When I showed David James Duncan an early draft of this, who's a real good friend of mine, probably one of my first readers. The manuscript came back, and every now and then he would write this acronym, which stood for poet, colon, write prose, exclamation point. You know, so it did take me a long time to try to weed myself out of the impulse to poeticize something that really didn't need to be poeticized.
Are you bitter because you just can't make poetry pay?
Oh, no. That took me, a minute.
I don't mean
or two
you. Are you bitter because one cannot make poetry?
No, that's why poetry. There's a great Guy Clark song about that, right? That's what keeps the poet free. I forget what the actual line is, but no, poetry's not supposed to pay. It's below money. It's above money. It hovers in the ether.
It's romantics. It's lovemaking.
Yeah.
That pays.
Yeah. In the right field, it does.
I haven't found a way to make it pay, but matter of fact, it's cost me quite a sum of money. But so you don't, do you still write poems?
Yeah, I have a new book of poems coming out in March. It's called Ragged Anthem. It actually has, there's three hunting poems in it. I can't, trying to remember.
Yeah, because you were once telling me that you didn't like to mix fishing and poem writing.
Nope. And I actually went back and looked. There's one poem in there, the last poem in the book. It's not a fishing poem, but it is a poem that has a brook trout in it that's actually grabbed, you know, by hand and eaten over a stick fire. It's, you know, you can't, what can you say about poetry? Everybody's going to just turn their phones off.
No, let me rip out a line of poetry and then you tell me who said it.
Okay.
There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. It's Bob Service.
Robert Service.
Cremation, okay. Sam McGee.
Okay. All right. You got me.
Can I rip out another one?
Sure.
This is the only poem I know.
Okay.
How was the hunting, Hunter Bold? Brother, the watch was long and cold.
Ooh. Bob Service?
No, it's Kipling.
Okay.
Good rip on out a line of poetry.
Oh, man. You know, yesterday was Harrison's birthday. He has a great line from a poem called Cabbage. If only I had the genius of a cabbage or even an onion to grow myself in their laminae from the holy core that bespeaks the final shape.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Gives me a little choke.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned Gearock. He was sweet to this book. I'd never met him before. I'd grown up reading him. You know, I read everything I could. And then my publicist called me up in November, right after the book came out, and said, you know, a guy named John Gyrich? And I said, what? She's John, some writer, John Guy. I said, John Gearock. She said, yeah, you better check the Wall Street Journal. He just wrote a review on Body of Water. So, you know, he'd written a beauty.
This quote on the back of the book, you didn't know he was putting that in there in advance?
No, that's the paperback. So, you know, he wrote the review about the hardback and I had no idea. No, I just saw the literal paper. Which was fantastic.
It was the first thing I saw obviously it's a top quote, but it definitely stuck out to me when I saw the Body of Water.
But he came up to Missoula last year to give a reading. It was a fantastic crowd out there. And we had a nice dinner and he said, you know, he said, you wrote a good book. I said, well, thanks. You know, it's really humbling to hear it. And he said, but you can only write one bad one. get back to work.
Of the book, he says, Chris Dombrowski's exacting descriptions of the sport make me long to try it again and to wish that more fishing books were written by poets.
Oh,
sweet.
That's amazing.
Nice. Yeah, it is.
I'm excited to read it, but I'm kind of scared. I don't want to get sucked into wanting to fish for bonefish again.
You know what's funny? I have such little desire to fish for bonefish at this point.
After all that?
I know, yeah. Why? What I don't miss, what I don't think I'll ever not want to do is the hunt, the visual hunt for the fish. And we were talking about this earlier, you know.
The preferred way.
The preferred way. I think it's preferred because it does. It takes us back, way back into that like Pleistocene brain that has really not been missing from our world for too long. It's, you know, our new brain hasn't been in existence.
It's not up to date.
No, it's not. So we desire that. We crave that language of that visual language. And so
it's that adrenaline that doctor was talking about. I mean, I would imagine if it got cold out there, which it does, you know, you heat up in that moment. And then if it's cold, you get cold again.
Gotta chill. If you gotta take a heater. So I've been thinking about something you said, April, and you're right.
Dynamite is not the most. No, just kidding.
You're right about this. If one found themselves in bonefish country and someone put a gun to your head and they're like, you catch one as fast as possible or I'll shoot you. Yeah, man. that's probably what you would set out to do is go look for one.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go out and just start wailing away out.
Or go find a big mud ball. A big mud ball.
And look, you and April, you guys are probably more of an expert on this than I. But I know people that guide bonefish in the Keys. And I think that if you put that question to at least two of my buddies down there and what tool they would use, they'd say a very noodly spin casting rod with a shrimp on it.
Sure.
But
I wasn't necessarily saying that the fly is the most productive. I'm saying sight fishing for them and casting to them. Yeah. Like a live crab in the flats, that's going to clean up everywhere. So it doesn't matter if it's fly or bait, but it's the sight fishing and specifically tracking that fish rather than just blind casting over and over again and hoping one goes by.
And the likelihood that you're going to spook one if you're just casting over them. Over and over.
You know what book sent me down to want to go catch one real bad? You remember, dude, I don't know if he's on the scene anymore, Randall Kaufman?
Yeah.
He was kind of big out like Oregon and shit like that and sold fly tying equipment and whatnot.
Kaufman's.
He had a book. Yeah, Kaufman's Streamborn.
Right.
He had a bonefish book.
It's big. It's hardback. Great photos. It was a
beautiful
book.
And then my brother Danny had one of those. My brother Danny's a fisheries biologist. I think you know this. He's a big fly pole fisherman. He, to this day, he had one of those calendars where it's like 365 fishing pictures.
I think I had this too.
Yeah, and every third one was a bonefish picture or some dude out in the flats or some dude doing something like that. And, you know, every third day you're like, damn, that looks cool. And that's what, like, you know, it was being inspired not by people. I didn't know anybody that had ever done it. It wasn't being inspired by people who did it. It was being inspired by art. I feel like art, it's one of those things that art sends you to do it. Art doesn't send you to fish through the ice. Something else sends you to fish through the ice. No. It's not art. But art propels one, you know.
Madness sends you to the ice.
And hunger.
Madness and hunger. Or a buzz.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just so easy to catch a lot of bonefish in a lot of places. I mean, not always. I always say to people that, you know, especially people who are new to fishing salt, bonefish are an excellent way to hone up your skills. I don't want to take you permit fishing if you haven't gone bone fishing.
Because then you're just going to be, like, miserable.
Well, and they can be difficult, especially those big ones. I mean, they are just a whole new world, right?
And if you see someone get nervous in front of a bonefish, you know they're just going to see a permit.
Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot of opportunity for this art because it is pretty. I mean, you can go to Belize and catch 50 bonefish.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, especially if you're casting into like a big mud.
Over a day or you mean over a trip?
That depends. But definitely easy over a trip. Man. Easy over. I mean, there'll be in a big mud pile, right? So you're literally just casting your fly in and stripping and anything's going to bite.
Man, that makes me feel like I was going about it all wrong. Man, we were like kicking ass to catch a few of them.
Well, that's what it should be like.
Yeah, the purists frown upon throwing into the muds.
But if you're a guide, if you're a guide or a host, and it's day six or day five of day six,
it's tasteless to throw into a mud. I think it'd be like the pinnacle of the trip.
It depends who you're talking to. It depends who you're talking. Personally, I really don't care. But for some people, it can be deemed.
No,
tasteless.
The muds are really cool. You see this kind of dense cloud of milky water, and then you just see a little flash or two up the top.
Yeah, little tails wagging around.
I do have to kind of disagree with you, though. Like your earlier comment, April. And
is this the one I doubled back around to agree with?
Well, like the why bonefish? Like, hadn't he ever heard of permit?
Oh, you mean in the 50s? Yeah. Or why him?
Yeah, because, I mean, just think of all the species.
That was a bit of tongue-in-cheek, right?
But it's like these things come in and out of fashion, too. Like fly fishing or fishing in general is, you know, it's like driven by what's cool, not
and I know a lot of
exactly
people,
the fish,
Ryan,
right?
Who love bonefish and do not like to go fishing for permit or even tarpon. Yeah. I know a lot of people who are into that. But a lot of this also has to do with, like, in the 50s, I don't know, we don't have enough time to jump into the history of, like, Joe Brooks and a lot of those guys. But a lot of that, like you're saying, it was fashionable, or a lot of people knew at that time that they could catch bonefish, but they didn't know that you could catch permit. So it wasn't necessarily that. I mean, a lot of it could have just been that he didn't know that he could catch permit.
Yeah. Pure ignorance.
Right. Yeah, but it's just being, like, nobody fishes, you know, 5 years ago, nobody threw flies at triggerfish, and like yes. everybody wants to catch triggerfish right. now, right?
Well, they did 5 years ago, but it's really trendy. Yeah,
now it's the hip. Like
you're right. It goes through. It goes.
Here's
it
my picture
flows.
Of my triggerfish.
Yeah. right. Well, that's. I was going to get to that. I mean, I think even 10, 15 years ago, people thought you couldn't catch permit. You know, now we think they're tough. Late in the book, this guy David Pinder, this amazing human being and one of the great guides and anglers in the Caribbean, tells this story. We're at Alma's Diner, this tiny little shack of a diner in McLeanstown.
He sells the conch fritters.
Conch fritters, lobsters, you know, peas and rice. I always get it wrong. Peas and rice. And somehow one of his sons winds him into this glory story of having guided back in the 80s a man, a Coca-Cola executive, into a double on permit. He and his partner doubled on permit and landed them simultaneously, you know? Okay. So it's a story that is told in great detail, and it's like an amazing one fish goes east and peels into the backing and leaves just a couple cranks left on the reel. And the other fish goes north and does the same thing. And Pinder has to make these incredible adjustments to land both of these fish. And they do. I remember going home after hearing that story and thinking, maybe, you know, we'd fallen over into the edge of myth and lore and this didn't actually happen. But at this point in the book, I was going to give Pinder his own voice, right? He'd earned it. And so I left it as is. You know, he told the story, it happened. But in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, well, was that a little bit of a fish tale? So the book had been out maybe 3, 4, 5 months. And I get this private message on my Facebook author page. And it's a picture, an old black and white picture of this old dude they called the Coca-Cola man and Pinder sitting on the dock with these two permit. And the picture had been sent by this guy who basically captains a yacht for the Coca-Cola man. And they go all over the world and fish. And he said, I was reading your book and I got to this passage about the double on permit. And I said, oh my God, hey boss, come here. You got to take a look at this or whatever. So he, you know, procured a picture, was down in the lodge or the bar of the yacht, and he took a picture of it and sent it to me. And
that's great.
That's good.
It was cool.
I might have told this before, but on the difficulty of permit, I was down with my brother one time. We were in the Bahamas, my brother Danny, and he was out wandering around looking for bonefish. And I was taking some, we had been spearfishing, and I was taking some snapper heads and catching some little sharks. And I hook a big ray. You know, permits like to follow rays around.
These do too. Yeah.
So the ray goes along, and the ray just goes along, and he's moving along, and he's silting, he's stirring up the silt and spooking up stuff. And so permit just and bonefish will just get in the habit of following behind him to see what they kick up. So here I have a big ray on the end of my line. Okay. And after a couple seconds, there's two permit in mudding behind the ray because he's raising the real ruckus because I got him on my line. So I motioned frantically for Danny to come over because here, what better scenario? You have two permit that you know are feeding. They're like looking for food because they're following behind the ray. And the ray's kicking up so much silt that there's like dust in the air, dust in the water. So it would presumably like impair the permit's vision in some way. And he is able to just take cast after cast because I can reel the ray in and then let him back out again, let the drag loose. And he goes back out and the permit and the ray go out and the permit and the ray come in, the permit. And meanwhile, he's like cast after cast after cast after cast. Sons of bitches would not
be. Never hooked it.
No, because they're like so
picky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, he's probably cooking.
They like run up and they want to. Right. Like, I'm going to kill that thing. I'm going to stop and smell it.
Look at the size of their eyes. I mean, oh, man. That's, did you hook that ray on purpose?
No, I was trying to catch sharks and the ray picked it up.
Gotcha. Okay.
I that ray lives today. Well, unless something else killed it. A hammerhead shark might have come and killed it. I don't know. I didn't mess with it. Chris Dombrowski, body, not the body, but body of water.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, people should go read the book, man.
Please do.
It's got like a real, it tells a cool story. And it tells you, and it tells you what to do about it.
There's a bunch of good guiding, David guiding stories in there. Another one pops into the head where he's got the investor and the original owner in the boat. And I'm not going to give it away because you got to go get and read Body of Water to get this story. But that's a good one. Like, there's a fish on and then all hope is lost. But then the guide says, you know what? Let's try this. And yeah.
And this is coming from a former guide, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I could go on. I know we're short on time, but I was just thinking about the times where rowing a boat, you know, you got two fish on and they're not just like any two fish where you're like, yeah, just skip that thing across the surface. But these things are like bowing a rod over. They're on the bottom of the river. And you're like, okay, what am I going to do? How's this going to work? Oh, there's a rapid coming up. Holy shit. And then somehow you're at the bottom of the rapid and you got two fish in one net. And it's just everybody's, yeah, Yori! Kristen Browski. Oh,
yeah, those are good times. Good stories.
Kristen Browski, Body of Water. Folks can go buy it on Amazon, right?
You bet.
And you got to know that you have influenced at least one more dirty bum fishing guide to pursue his writing dreams. And my buddy Colin Scott, he wanted me to be sure to let you know that he really looks up to you, and you let him know that it is in fact possible. So he's still bumming it in AK and writing screenplays.
Nice.
So you're not only are you ruining bonefish,
I'm by, ruining by people,
clouding it up. You're ruining writing.
Yeah,
bringing in all kind of writers now.
I know it.
Competing for precious limited resources.
Pretty soon they're all going to have TV shows too.
Come on now.
Oh, it's great to be here. You guys are fantastic.
Thank you very much, everyone.